Welcome back to Teaching Tuesdays. Today we're doing the continuation of what we've been reading on Fridays and rounding up everything from the novel and talking about the important things from it. If you've been keeping up with our Friday reading corners, you'll know that we just finished C.S. Lewis's Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which was the second book in his Chronicles of Narnia series that we've been reading. So today we're going to talk about Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and some of the things that you need to really take away from the book and what is important and all that fun wonderfulness. Alright, so like always, or like we did with the first novel that one time, so this being our second time, we're going to talk about the themes, motifs, symbols, that sort of thing that really needs to be discussed about the novel, things that I think are important when it comes to understanding why C.S. Lewis wrote the book, what elements came out from it, whether they are intentional or unintentional. So the first thing I want to talk about are some of the themes. One thing in the theme is, let me backtrack a bit. C.S. Lewis wrote his Chronicles of Narnia series for children as a way to help them kind of in a way understand the Bible. And so a lot of the things I'll be talking about will have biblical elements, if that's something that you're really not into, you might not want to listen, but it will help you understand the book a little bit better if you listen today and get a little bit of that information. So let's go back into it. So like I said a little bit ago, themes are what we're going to start with. First theme I want to talk about is gluttony, the dangers of it. There are a lot of critics who say that each of the seven novels in Chronicles of Narnia deal with one of the seven deadly sins. Now, whether or not that's really true, it is certainly the case in the novel we just finished, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, because it specifically focuses on gluttony as one of the seven sins that were prevalent. Because, if you remember, Edmund, he became enrolled, I don't know if that's a good word to say, in the witch's service, and that began with his frantic consumption of the Turkish delight, which was magical. Now, because it was enchanted, he couldn't be held accountable for his gluttony, as if he were, you know, overindulging on ordinary candy. But it's the real sin occurs when Edmund allows himself to become fixated on the Turkish delight long after he leaves the witch's company. Because if you remember, he was walking back. Let me backtrack a little bit. He left the witch's services, went with Lucy back to the real world. What can I need to think about there? Then they all four of them ended up being caught up in the wardrobe, thinking Mrs. MacCready was going to catch them. They have the whole meeting up in Narnia, walking to Mr. Tumnus's house, finding him not there, meeting Mr. Beaver, going to the Beaver's house, finding out about Aslan. And when Edmund started leaving the Beaver's house and started walking towards the witch's castle, one of the things he was thinking about was the Turkish delight. Now, some people say that Edmund's consumption of the Turkish delight may have been a reference to the sin of Adam and Eve when they ate from the tree of knowledge. Now, Adam and Eve, they committed a sin eating the fruit from that tree. God punished them because of it. Now, Edmund's gluttony for the Turkish delight might allude to Adam and Eve's desire to eat the fruit of the tree. That's one possibility. I'm not sure if that, as I was doing my research, that was something that came up. I don't know for sure if that could be a good correlation, but I'll let you guys be the deciders on that. Another theme was This one, again, is very religious. The Power of Satan, because if you haven't picked up, the White Witch, Jadis, also from Magician's Nephew, was seen as our villainous character in both the books, relating, and was the fictitious version of Satan. So we still have that religious power of Satan influence here on the story. Edmund, of course, was the traitor in the story, and his life was forfeit to the White Witch, just as any sinner, their life was forfeit to Satan after death without the intervention of God. Now, the White Witch may not be an exact representation of Satan. You know, the imagery that surrounds her does not, you know, quite fit the devil himself. Perhaps she was a servant of Satan and an overlord of Narnia, being therefore Narnia's special patron demon. But the witch claims the lives of all Narnians who sin irrevocably, which would be an illusion, not illusion, to Satan's claim of the souls of each of those who sin. Another theme would be humankind's redemption. So not everything in Narnia directly parallels the story of Jesus, but the similarities are, you know, very striking, and so much so that it can't be ignored. One, Aslan sacrifices his life to save Edmund, just like Christ gave his life to save mankind. Through Aslan's death, Edmund's sins were expunged, and Edmund is permitted to live, not have to pay the price for his wrongdoings. That's the same thing that Christ did for us, because mankind is permitted to live in heaven, now that Christ's death has expunged the original sin that Adam and Eve committed when they disobeyed God in the Garden of Eden. Now, Lewis's goal is to present us with a variation to the Christian legends, quote-unquote, or the stories, the main stories from the Bible that everyone needs to know. Narnia presents us with a different perspective on faith and helps with the story of Jesus come to life. Again, we have to deal with this whole Christian allegory issue and debate. As I said earlier, C.S. Lewis was a devout Christian. He suffused his most famous work, being this novel, Lion Witch Wardrobe, with overt Christian symbolism, and structured its conclusion in the resurrection of a Christ figure and a climactic battle for the very soul of Narnia. Lewis, however, didn't set out to write a biblical allegory, because when it came to actually writing the books, he wrote The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe first. It was the first one to be published, XYZ, which is why there's that whole debate as to whether or not the whole series to be read chronologically or in the order that he wrote them. So, The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe was what the book he wrote originally that started the whole Chronicles of Narnia series. But I'm in the boat that you read it chronologically to help make sense. But that's a whole nother rabbit trail horse to ride later and for that discussion. But we need to get back to this whole Christian allegory discussion. As I said, Lewis did not set out to write a biblical allegory. Instead, he wanted to imbue a fairy story with elements of the story of Jesus Christ in order to allow children to see the miraculous elements of Christ's story in a new light, perhaps to relate to them anew and understand their wonder more deeply. Now, through the character of Aslan and his role in Peter, Edmund, Susan, Lucy's story, Lewis was able to create an allegory for the triumph of Christian ideology and use this book to subtly suggest that a world that rejects Christianity with the poor will be a poorer one, marked by strife, suffering, and a literal winter of the soul. Now, in contrast, a world that embraces Christ-like values, you know, turning the other cheek, honoring promises, making sacrifices for other, believing what Jesus did, and following his commandments will be a full, bountiful, and prosperous world to live in. Now, the religious symbolism that Lewis employs throughout the novel is pointed and ubiquitous. From Lucy's first solo journey through the wardrobe to the world on the other side, there is the sense that Lewis will create a world that's in dire need of deliverance. Lucy finds Narnia covered in snow on her first time through the wardrobe. This initially gives the world a quiet, still magic, and Lucy sees Mr. Tumnus carrying packages in his arms. You know, she believes Christmas must be near. However, Tumnus then reveals that the world of Narnia is under siege. The White Witch is made so that it's always winter and never Christmas in Narnia. This, you know, keeping Christmas back, which is a holiday that commemorates the birth of Christ, it's implied to be a purposeful withholding of the celebration of Jesus. Mr. Tumnus also notably refers to Lucy as a daughter of Eve. That's the way that Narnians refer to humans, as daughters of Eve for women, sons of Adam for men. That's another biblical reference that points to humans as divine creations of God's image, and their fated destiny to rule Narnia above all the other magical creatures who live there is, in a way, a divine right. Lucy and her siblings will be heralded as saviors, or deliverers destined to, alongside with Aslan, to pull Narnia from its eternal winter. Now, sin and corruption have come to roost in Narnia under the White Witch's rule, and Lewis uses the White Witch's forced perpetual winter as a metaphor for the desolation and emptiness of Narnia's soul in the absence of its ruler, Aslan, who is the figure for Christ in this book, or in this whole series, not just this one book. So Aslan is the most overt symbol of Christ in the novel, not just this one, but in all of the books. Just as the sound of the name inspires strong feelings in all who hear it in the story. The first time Aslan is mentioned to the children, if you remember, way back when they were talking with the beavers, Edmund feels a mysterious horror. Peter feels suddenly brave. Susan feels something delicious or delightful float by her. And Lucy feels a sense of gleeful anticipation, something like the feeling of waking up on the first day of a holiday or a vacation, as we would use in America. Lewis is clearly using Aslan's ineffable power to echo the feelings of horror that sinners and liars, such as Edmund, feel at the mention of the name of Christ. And then, on the flip side, the bravery, glee, and peace Christ's name inspires in his followers in the other three. So, Aslan's approach severely weakens the power of the White Witch, and after Edmund deserts the group to enter the employ or to work alongside the White Witch, the beavers bring Peter, Susan, and Lucy to the Narnian landmark of the stone table to meet Aslan, if you remember that in the story. And as all of them are making their way to the stone table, the beavers and the three Pevensey children, and then Edmund with the dwarf and the White Witch, they see the landscape change. So first, Peter, Susan, Lucy, and the beavers meet Father Christmas to deliver presents and to encourage the three children there that, yes, you are doing the right thing. But before he leaves, he shouts, "Merry Christmas, long live the true king." Now, this is an ostensibly a reference to Aslan, or possibly even the future High King Peter, as we find out in the last chapter that's his name. It's clear that it's a clear reference to Christ himself, who one of his names is that he's King of Kings. Meanwhile, as the White Witch travels to the stone table, she finds out her hold on Narnia's weakening by the snow melting, which is severely impeding the movement of their sleigh, the reindeer struggle as they continue on and the snow melts. So with this, Lewis shows that Aslan's power against the witch and symbolically Christianity's power against heretics and non-believers is to be powerful even from a distance. Lewis's belief in all of those who are believers of God and Jesus Christ, that belief in the almighty nature of them is evident in the novel as it speeds towards the climactic battle for Narnia's soul. So, of course, in the climax, Aslan and the White Witch face off at the stone table, that itself being a biblical symbol reminiscent of the stone tablets, bearing the commandments brought down from Sinai by Moses. The White Witch, with a concierge of giants, werewolves, spirits of the trees who are with her, they all confront Aslan at the table. The reason Aslan was there is because he rescued Edmund from the witch's clutches. And so now she taunts him and reminds him of this deep magic that the Emperor of Narnia put into the world at the very beginning of time. Under this deep magic, every traitor belongs to the White Witch. We all remember that Edmund was a traitor because he turned his back on Aslan and his siblings and all those who were good and all things are good in Narnia by telling the witch, hey, this is what's going on. I'm going to align with you, XYZ. This is, you know, we all know what he did. And because he's a traitor, as a traitor, he is hers to kill. In this way, she is an allegorical Satan to whom sinners belong to when they are sent to hell to pay for what they did. Aslan can't deny the power of the deep magic, but he makes a deal with the White Witch, allowing him to take Edmund's place. Thus, the most potent metaphor for the passion and crucifixion of Jesus Christ emerges there. So, Aladdin, I read the word Aslan in my notes and read Aladdin. I don't know why. It just kind of shows my kind of weird brain at the moment. But Aslan is led to the stone table by the witch's attendants. You know, the hags, the werewolves, spirits of the evil trees, XYZ, we remember that a little bit. And if you've seen the movies, you kind of know that we're kind of weird looking. He's led to the stone table, taunted, shamed, his mane is shaved off, he's tied up, he's muzzled. The witch then kills Aslan, and this horrifies Lucy and Susan, who just happened to be hiding out in the bushes at the edge of the wood, between the woods and the clearing, and they're mortified and horrified as they watch it. The witch and her minions then abandon Aslan's corpse to go to the battle to fight, because they're at such high after having killed Aslan. And so then Lucy and Susan go up there and tend him, taking the muzzle off of him, trying to get his ropes untied. Then as the sun rises, though, Aslan is resurrected before almost before their eyes, their backs are turned to him when he actually officially resurrects, but they were still there. And the stone table is cracked in two. As in the New Testament, during the resurrection and the crucifixion, Mary Magdalene attended Jesus' body ahead of his resurrection, during which Jesus rolled aside the stone boulder and emerged from the tomb. Lewis then creates a profound and instantly recognizable image of Aslan as Narnia's immortal savior, just like Jesus is the immortal savior of Christianity. So then after Aslan's resurrected, they all go to the battle ensues. That's very climactic. Aslan and all the four siblings are triumphant, because by now, Edmund has joined to fight beside Peter against the witch. And they're all triumphant, so Lewis's narrative confirms the inherent righteousness and ultimate unassailability of Christian values. The novel's central conflict is the struggle between Christianity's tenets of sacrifice, empathy, striving towards goodness and godliness, against sin and selfishness and godlessness. In couching this struggle and the symbol and metaphor in pitting Aslan and the White Witch against each other. Lewis literally lionizes Christianity and statutes, and situates the religion's central story, that of Jesus Christ, in a fantasy realm where its miraculous happenings and moral core can be viewed in a new light. Lewis has clearly influenced was by his Christian beliefs when he wrote this story, though it can also be read as just a simple tale of human growth, because I know that there are some people who don't believe in the Bible and those teachings, and therefore they see these books as just fairy tales, and then, you know, kind of like sci-fi fantasy type books. The stories of the Passion of Christ and the Resurrection of Christ are reflected in the character of the lion Aslan, who is the son of the defied Emperor Beyond the Sea. Aslan arrives to Narnia to save it from the White Witch. His decision to allow himself to be killed by the witch in Edmund's plays echoes Christ's willingness to die for the sins of mankind. Both Christ and Aslan walk to their deaths filled with the heavy sadness, fearful of pain and the suffering that they are about to endure, and struggle to maintain their faith that they will indeed be brought back to life. In a scene recalling the crucifixion of Christ, Aslan is tied down to the stone table and slain by a knife. After some time, Aslan returns to life and is more magnificent than ever. His resurrection inspires wonder, and Susan and Lucy, who both had to witness that. And if you have any more questions about the resurrection of Christ and you want to know more, I highly recommend that you find a church that deals heavily with teaching the Bible, and you ask questions of those who are there. Alright, so another theme that we find in this book is war. Because, of course, at the end, and a vast majority of the book talks about this upcoming war, or the war itself, or talking about the ramifications of what happened after the war ended. So, when Lucy first stumbled into the world of Narnia, she finds a mystical realm that at first seems full of only delights. There's these mythical creatures, delicious food, this calm, wintry scene that she sees, but pretty soon she finds out that it's a world full of war, just like the real world that she came from, because the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe takes place during World War II. So as the four siblings explore Narnia more expansively and deeply, they come to understand that Narnia's problems mirror the problems of our own world. In creating a fantasy world whose wartime sense of fear and oppression mirrors the atmosphere of World War II England, by, you know, unflinchingly demonstrating the horrors of war, Lewis suggests the war is an inescapable, unavoidable aspect of existence of any kind. And he argues that ignoring or attempting to avoid battles for important causes will ultimately allow evil to prevail. Lucy is only in Narnia for a short time before the first Narnian she meets, Mr. Tumnus, reveals that his seemingly idyllic land is actually under siege, having fallen into the clutches of the White Witch, who was evil. Lucy realizes that she's left one war-torn world for another. And though she returns to the real world for a time, the dark truth of what is really happening in Narnia will propel her to return again, this time bringing her siblings into the fold. The violence of World War II was unlike anything the world had yet seen. Not even a full generation removed from the horrors of World War I, World War II was less about trench warfare and hand-to-hand combat than it was about tactical deployment of advanced weaponry, mass destruction, extermination of Jews, Roma, homosexuals, other religious and cultural minorities. This great physical and personal violence is reflected in the war taking place in Narnia, where a despotic ruler seems to maintain power through unfair or dirty tactics, you know, by using spells, magic, enchantments, the bewitchment of Edmund, using Turkish delights that turns him to become a traitor to his own siblings. and the oppression of certain groups combined with the elevation of others. You know, the fauns, the nymphs, the dryads, and talking animals such as Mr. Beaver and Mr. and Mrs. Beaver all seem to be under constant threat of being turned to stone by the witch herself. As the four siblings explore more of Narnia and come to understand that the White Witch is only a pretender to the throne, you know, the throne being theirs because, you know, two sons of Adam, two daughters of Eve, and that is what they are, they find themselves deeply and intimately involved in the War of Narnia. Now, whereas in the real world, they were purposefully kept sheltered from the war, removed from London to go to the country, you know, which was the epicenter of violence and danger in the fantasy realm of Narnia, the children were at the very center of the action. So, where they were kept and sheltered from one horror in one realm, they were thrust into the center of it in another. And Lewis uses this coincidence and contradiction to reveal that perhaps the siblings' underlying anxiety in their real lives about being a part and unable to be part of the effort against World War II, as well as possibly their fear of being casualties of its violence. In Narnia, not only are the children pulled into the fray, they find themselves at the very heart of the battle, and able to, through their participation in it, turn the tides of the war between Aslan and the witch. In the climactic battle scenes towards the end of the novel, Lewis does not shy away from depicting violence. Talking animals are turned to stone. Aslan is humiliated by the witch and her evil cochere of monsters, and then brutally murdered. Peter plunges his sword into the heart of the witch's head guard, a wolf named Magrim. Aslan mauls the witch while dwarves raise their battle axes, dogs gnash their teeth, giants crush the enemy beneath their feet, centaurs and unicorns trample the witch's minions with their hooves. I'm sure the unicorns impaled people with their horns. I mean, that's a lot of violence, chaos, and bloodshed in the final pages, the final battle of the all there on the page. Though it's terrible carnage and many casualties, the Pevensey kids face down their enemies and are all ultimately able to turn the tides of the war in Narnia and help good to prevail. Now, this whole thing is set against the backdrop of one of the most terrible conflicts in human history. It examines the duality of the fight-or-flight impulses that comes in war. The four siblings at the center of the story are drawn into the conflict in Narnia and forced to confront the horrors of war despite all of the adults in the real world's best efforts to shield them from it. Yet, Lewis does not frame the children as victims or horrified onlookers. Rather, these siblings are eager to contribute to the war effort and conquer the fears of evil which threaten purity, goodness, righteousness. In a way, Lewis warns that sticking one's head into the sand and avoiding pain, struggle, violence, or conflict will only result in the triumph of evil. Another theme, you know, even though he only has a small part to play in the story, but Father Christmas is a good theme to look at. So in the story, Father Christmas symbolizes the benevolence and bounty Christianity has to offer. Lucy's first friend in Narnia, Mr. Tumnus, tells her that because the evil White Witch placed herself on the throne, it's always winter, but never Christmas, because in America and around the world, majority, Christmas is celebrated in the winter, or at least those in the Northern Hemisphere. So in this book, whose central thematic preoccupation is Christianity, the forever winter the White Witch has imposed in Narnia can be seen as a spiritual impoverishment and literal winter of the soul, that estrangement from Christianity and genders. The cold is brutal and debilitating, but as the true king of Narnia, Aslan approaches the land and the snow begins to thaw. On their way to meet Aslan, the children run into Father Christmas, or Santa Claus, depending on how you want to see it. He comes to bring presents for the Beavers, as well as for Lucy, Susan, and Peter. The gifts he gives the three siblings aren't toys, like you would mostly see children getting. but these are tools that he urges them to use in the upcoming battle against the witch. Now, this is where Lewis is demonstrating how Christianity, which is the essence of goodness and benevolence, also equips its adherents with tools, or the people who follow Christianity, believe in Christ, they have certain tools at their disposal that are needed to traverse the world, battle temptation, cruelty, and evil. As Father Christmas departs, he wishes all of the children a Merry Christmas and then calls out, long live the true King, as I mentioned earlier and as it stated in the book. And though Father Christmas, in this instance, is referring to Aslan, the true King of Narnia, his words undeniably echo Christians' belief in Jesus Christ as the one true King and the ultimate deliverer of his followers from sin and evil. So, I always want to reinforce that aspect because it is a pillar of the Christian faith, which is the next theme I want to talk about, faith. Now, the children had to learn a lot about how to have faith when all seemed to be lost. Peter had to find faith in himself in order to be able to become the High King. Susan and Lucy had to have faith that Aslan knew what he was doing when he was going to the stone table. And Edmund had to have faith that he would be forgiven for betraying everyone, and that everyone trusted or would trust him after this whole ordeal. The next thing is the redemptive qualities that we find throughout the book. It's a very good theme to hone in on. Of course, this whole book is an allegory for the crucifixion in the Bible, and it's just dripping with the possibility of redemption throughout it. Edmund was redeemed after he betrayed his siblings to the White Witch. Aslan took his place and paid the price that Edmund would have had to pay when he decided to leave the witch and rejoin Aslan. When Edmund is rescued from certain death at the hand of the White Witch, he has a long talk with Aslan, the contents of which no one knows except for the lion and Edmund. Edmund was forgiven by Aslan, as made known by the way Aslan treated him and taking his place. Now he introduced Edmund back to his siblings. He was forgiven by his brother and his sisters, all of whom agreed that the past is the past, no need to harp on it. So this whole supreme act of forgiveness and self-sacrifice is made by Aslan, who accepts death at the hand of the White Witch in Edmund's place. He believes that Edmund's life is worth dying for in spite of his past actions. Lewis appears to believe that forgiveness for past mistakes is the way that relationships heal and strengthen. And it's the foundation for a strong community and strong relationships between anyone. Another theme I want to briefly talk about is rebirth. There are numerous examples of this throughout the book, but I just want to talk about some of the biggest ones. The biggest one, of course, being Aslan. He became alive the morning after he was killed on the stone table. Another one is Edmund. He was reborn when he became a new man and was given a second chance with all those in Narnia and his siblings. Now, I want to talk a bit about this alternative education idea, because the whole reason that the children were able to get into the wardrobe was because they were in the country, not in London where they lived. And that, of course, has to deal with World War II going on in London, being the epicenter in England. The children were sent to the country for protection, and that's where they found the wardrobe, which caused them to be able to find Narnia. And if you remember, Peter and Susan talked with the professor about stuff, but I don't want to get too involved and miss something, so I'm going to go back to my notes. Okay, so of course the four children, of course, as I said, stayed with the professor at his house in the country during the war because of the air raids. Possibly the children were presented with an alternative education to supplement the one that would have been provided for them at their schools in London. The professor gives Peter and Susan a strange yet valuable lesson in logic when he suggests that Lucy may be telling the truth about Narnia. Additionally, the professor repeatedly expressed his exasperation with the school system, lending credence to the possibility that Lewis himself was frustrated with the English educational system. the increasingly negative personality that Edmund had been exhibiting at school worries Peter and Susan. Their quest in the world of Narnia, however, leads the children through a process of spiritual transformation that is particularly significant for Edmund. In Narnia, the children are exposed to critical lessons about friendship, loyalty, good judgment, forgiveness, faith, courage, and self-sacrifice. The reader is invited along on this journey, but learning these lessons requires imagination and a willingness to trust in the simple, clear logic that suggests that a world like Narnia might actually exist. The universe that Lewis presents to his readers becomes a vehicle through which he offers an alternative means for learning the crucial elements of personal and spiritual growth. So again, you know, talking about the alternative education and the logic that the professor talked about and the faith I talked about a little bit more earlier, I want to talk more about it a bit. So when Peter and Susan approach the professor with their concerns about Lucy and her story of Narnia, the professor leads them through a simple exercise in logic in which he takes what they know to be true, one, that Lucy is a truthful girl, what they have observed, Lucy has not gone mad, in order to reach a logical conclusion. This conclusion, the professor suggests, is that Narnia is true, and it's not a story. Acceptance of this logical conclusion, however, requires a significant amount of faith. In this manner, Lewis constructs a scaffolding for a narrative that will enable the reader to believe in the existence of a place like Narnia. The skepticism that detracts from the possibility that Lewis's story about Narnia is true is expressed in Edmund, who questions the benevolence of the Robin that, you know, questions Mr. Tumnus and Mr. Beaver. The White Witch herself also expresses skepticism about whether or not Aslan will keep the promise he has made to her. In each of these cases, there is a logical argument that could be made in support of faith, yet the skeptics exhibit little willingness to accept the goodness of the other characters. Now, another thing I want to talk about is childhood. That's kind of a theme throughout this story. Because the story can be read as a children's story. Lewis certainly makes use of this genre, and the form is essentially that of a fairy tale, because if you read the dedication at the beginning, it's to his niece, Lucy. And he talks about, you know, by the time I get to finish writing this, get it published and out and about, you're going to have grown up and not really believe it in this as much as you would have when I first started writing the book, which deals with childhood. When you're a child, you believe in these sorts of things more easily. However, there's more that can be said about childhood in this book. Lucy, in the story, is the youngest and, of course, is the first to express curiosity about the wardrobe. Without her pure, innocent curiosity, the children would not have never traveled to Narnia. Throughout the story, Lucy is depicted as the most observant of all the characters. In the end, even as she takes the throne, she maintains a delightful childlike quality, even as she grows and all the other kids grow up, because she is known to be that kind of a person. Through Lucy's innocence, Lewis shows the importance of clinging to what one knows to be true, loyalty, friendship, and genuine faith. If one possesses these attributes, he appears to believe, there is no place for skepticism. Alright, so the next theme I want to talk about is courage. Peter and Edmund both come of age by translating their specific skills into remarkable acts of courage, particularly when it comes to the battle scene. Peter exhibits his valor by killing the Grey Wolf before the battle even starts. Edmund shows his courage by making the most of the clean slate he's been given, smashing the White Witch's wand during the last battle. Aslan knights both of those boys in order to reward their bravery. Aslan is, of course, another example of a courageous character because he faces death without turning his back on his promise. Another theme I want to talk about would be the friendship and loyalty. Lucy and Mr. Tumnus are the first true friends that we see in this book. Lucy gives away her handkerchief to him and Mr. Tumnus refuses to turn his new friend into the White Witch. Friendship is later exemplified in the characters of Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, who lead the children to the stone table, where they find Aslan. Mr. Beaver shows Lucy's handkerchief as a sign that he is a friend of Mr. Tumnus, and therefore a friend of Lucy. Lucy shows loyalty to Mr. Tumnus. Her show of it to him is also a driving force behind the story, and that the characters do all they can to save him. Now, there are a lot of meals that take place and are mentioned in the story. Lucy lunches with Mr. Tumnus, and the wholesome meal prepared by Mr. and Mrs. Beaver stand in stark contrast to Edmund's endless appetite for the Turkish delight given to him by the White Witch. The meals with Mr. Tumnus and Mr. and Mrs. Beaver are accompanied by friendship and useful conversation, including stories about the forest, information about Aslan, and the like. The White Witch's gift of Turkish delight, however, is purely evil and intended to create in Edmund an unhealthy, insatiable appetite for more, thereby transforming him into her slave. Then there's the tea tray that Father Christmas presents to the Beavers and the children, along with the breakfast in the forest that the White Witch and Edmund stumble upon, revealing that meals can serve as celebrations of good cheer, friendship, and family. The White Witch, however, calls the meal sheer gluttony and changes the creatures consuming it into stone. The fact that the White Witch herself is never seen eating suggests that she is different from the other good creatures. That is the last of the themes that I had to go for us. Yeah, that took quite a bit of time to talk about, but all of those themes are good. So I want to go ahead and move on to some of the motifs. Alright, so the first one I want to talk about are the seasons, because this book deals heavily with the changing of the seasons, going from one season to the next, and that transition between them. So, the witch imposes an enchanted and eternal winter on Narnia, symbolizing a dead, stagnant time. Nothing grows, animals hibernate during the winter, and people crouch around fires rather than enjoying the outdoors. Nearly every human being has a visceral, negative reaction to winter, even when it is normal length of time. We can imagine how quickly an eternal winter would become intolerable. The witch's winter destroys the beauty and life in Narnia. There is a pristine appeal to woods blanketed in snow and frozen waterfalls, but our overall impression is one of barren, empty land. The season of winter represents that Narnia has fallen under an evil regime. As snow falls, so does the land of Narnia. The witch's snow hides all traces of Aslan or the Emperor beyond the sea. Narnia is undoubtedly bleak and grim. How much more wondrous, then, is the spring that occurs when Aslan arrives in Narnia? Of course, Christmas occurs before spring can come, because Christmas is the birth of Christ. It is Christmas that signals hope for mankind. With the birth of Christ, we are given the hope of new life. Spring follows Christmas, and all of a sudden the woods are completely alive. Flowers are blooming, springs and brooks are chuckling, birds are singing, and delightful smells waft past on gentle breezes. This is no ordinary spring, though, just as the witch's winter is no ordinary winter. The spring is just as enchanted as the winter, only now Narnia is experiencing the epitome of life rather than death. That's pretty much the only motif that I really wanted to focus on today, and I don't want to take up too much more time, so we're going to move on. We're going to move on to some of the symbols. So the first one is, of course, Aslan, if you haven't noticed. When talking about all of the themes, I talked about how Aslan, certain characters symbolized certain elements and people in the Christian stories and religion. So Aslan, so in the story, which is an allegory of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Aslan represents Christ. Aslan's death to save Edmund's life and his subsequent resurrection are clear references to the life of Jesus Christ. Lewis's novel makes some essential changes to this figure that makes Aslan more accessible to children than the Christ they learned about in church. Lewis's method worked well. He even received a letter from a very distraught little boy pleading for help because he could not help loving Aslan more than Jesus, even though he knew he was supposed to love Jesus above everything else. The very shift from a man to a lion is quite significant. Jesus Christ is a human being, which is both confusing and compelling, particularly for a child. Christ seems almost too familiar to a small child, blurring the boundaries between a God who deserves reverence and a friend who deserves affection. The beauty of the figure of a lion is that a child would have no problem showing both emotions for a lion. A lion, as the king of the forest, is fearful and intimidating. The lion's also a big cat, and Lewis emphasizes the side of Aslan by depicting him as romping and playing merrily with the kids. So a talking animal at once inspires love and respect, magic, and mystery. Lewis adapts the figure of Jesus for children while still maintaining all of the essential characteristics of Christ. Alright, the next symbol I want to talk about is the stone table. The stone table, as I mentioned before, represents and refers to the stone tablets that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai back in the book of Exodus. These tablets contain the Ten Commandments and they represent the older, stricter form of religion as found in the Old Testament. In the days of the Ten Commandments, when they were brought down from the mountain, infractions against God would be made punishable by death. Retribution was swift, harsh, and irrevocable. When Aslan rises from the dead, the stone table is shattered, signifying the end of an older, crueler time and the advent of a newer, kinder era that we find in the New Testament. Aslan has defeated death by rising from the dead, signalizing the end of harsh customs and death as an acceptable punishment. Instead, human beings enforce justice and mete out punishments. Alright, the next symbol I want to talk about is the sea, because if you remember, Kara Paravel was located at the mouth of the river that went from the western side of Narnia all the way to the eastern seaboard into the sea. So there's only a few passages throughout the entire book that actually mentions the sea, but these are significant because of the context of the story. We only get a glimpse of the sea, and we learn that the emperor over the sea, who's Aslan's father, God himself, the sea becomes a boundary between Narnia, the earth, and Aslan's country, which is heaven. Lewis reveals in later novels, that we'll read later, that it's actually possible to physically sail across the sea to Aslan's country. I don't want to give away too much. Moreover, the sea is also a boundary between Narnia and our world. In traditional imagery, the sea often represents death, and that seems rather appropriate here, but not death in the sense that we have to come to know and dread it, as like the Grim Reaper with a hood and a scythe. Rather, it's death that is life, or death as rebirth into heaven. Which, if you want to know more about that, I recommend that you go to a church that deals heavily with teaching the Bible. Alright, so the next symbol I want to talk about is really quick and easy. That would be Narnia in itself. The land country of Narnia is the fantastical version of Earth. Yes, there are mythical creatures in the land of Narnia that don't belong in our world, but remember, Narnia is just a representation of Earth, not the real thing. Therefore, the mythical creatures are representations of the people who live on Earth, not the real thing. Even though sometimes we might see elements that would recommend that they are mythical creatures, but that's a whole nother rabbit trail that we're not going to go down today. Alright, the last symbol I want to talk about is, of course, the White Witch. The White Witch, who we know from The Magician's Nephew as Jadis, is the representation of Satan. In The Magician's Nephew, Jadis tempted Diggory, just as like Satan tempted Adam and Eve. Here in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Satan, the Witch, fought against Aslan, who is Jesus Christ, and those who follow him. The witch has thrived in the land for a long time, having, in a way, pulled the wool over the eyes of all the people who live there and who have joined her side. She has risen to the heights of the land, making everyone bow down to her, whether it's willing or not. Alright, so I have some questions that, as I was researching, I came across. I was like, oh, I really like that. So, one question is, to evaluate the character of Edmund, to what extent is he a helpless victim of the witch's deceit through the Turkish delight, and to what extent is he the master of his own fate? We can argue that the Turkish delight enchanted Edmund, and that he was compelled to befriend the witch and be a traitor to his siblings. Lewis, however, does not seem to endorse that idea that Edmund lacked complete control of his actions, but he doesn't condemn Edmund. He makes it clear that Edmund lacks morals and maturity. Lewis does not excuse Edmund's behavior by linking it to the witch's magic candy. Edmund succumbs to the temptation of the Turkish delight without a struggle. If Lewis had written that Edmund was conflicted and tried to control his desires for the Turkish delight, Edmund would have deserved more of our sympathy. Edmund does not put up a effort to fight his greed. He fixates on the Turkish delight consciously and constantly, even after he is away from the witch. Edmund allows his greed for the Turkish delight to impair his judgment and blind him to the witch's cruelty. Aslan also does not excuse Edmund's behavior because of the Turkish delight. Edmund's sin is not that he indulges in it, but that Edmund's greed causes him to make poor decisions and endanger his siblings in the land of Narnia. Lewis's portrayal of Edmund condemns the devil, maybe do it excuse. So the next question I always want to ask is, what does Narnia really symbolize? And we kind of talked about that in symbols, but I wanted to hint on it a little bit more here. We may be tempted to argue that Narnia represents the simple, unchallenged faith that lies in a child's heart. We might also think that Narnia does not represent anything in our world except perhaps the earth itself. Narnia is the one component of the book that is literal and can stand on its own without the Christian legend, or the Christian religion. In the novel, the children really do travel to another world. There is just not an allegorical journey that takes place in the children's psyche or dreams. This other world of Narnia adheres to the same basic rules and structures as our own. They have seasons like we do, and they believe in right and wrong, and that killing someone is wrong. Christians believe that we are united by one God, and by his Son, his only Son, and the laws that bind God and all of his creations. Narnian world is a Christian world, except the Narnian God takes the shape of a lion instead of a man. The Pevensey children, like the reader, learn about God and Christ through their adventure in Narnia. Lewis uses Narnia because it fulfills a child's fantasy of another world. The magical land of Narnia makes the story of Christianity more accessible, but it does not actually represent anything in allegorical terms. Narnia is the setting for the allegory, but it's not a direct symbol which corresponds with any one thing in our world. Okay, so what moral lesson does Aslan teach Lucy with regards to how she uses her bottle or the fire flower juice? So in the book, Aslan has said, others are also at the point of death. Must more people die for Edmund? Because he had originally told Lucy, hey, there are others need your help. And Lucy said, just a minute, because she was so focused on Edmund. And he said, others are also to the point of death. Must more people die because of Edmund? For him. Meaning, he had already died for Edmund. There were a lot of people on the battlefield who had been turned to stone because the White Witch wanted Edmund and he had turned to the good side. Those few people were fighting for him. So, in a way, I was thinking that he was telling her that she can't make the decision of who lives and dies. The fireflower juice is the magical version, possibly, of the fountain of youth, in a way, or eternal life that we find in Jesus. Goose heals all who ingest it and revives them from their original form to their original form, because while Aslan was going to taking care of the people who had been turned to stone, Lucy took care of those who were injured and dying, just like Edmund was. So those are my 2 cents. I want to try and get this done quickly. We are on the last question. So why is Lucy the youngest child, the first to enter Narnia, Edmund the next youngest, the second one to enter? Is it a coincidence, or is Lewis making a point about the ability of younger children to be more open-minded? It could possibly be the point that he was trying to make, since Jesus in the Bible even said that children are more willing to believe. It's easier for them to believe something if you tell them once. He said that the belief that the faith of a child is what adults should strive for. Lewis, I think, was using this point to point out that no matter what child is there, is out there, they will easily believe whatever is taught them until they have been shown everything. Edmund was taught by the White Witch before he was taught about Aslan and eventually met him. The others met Aslan first, and those who had already met and believed him. That's, I think, the main point Lewis is making here. How a child is educated and what they are exposed to are what makes them the adults that they will become. So those are all my 2 cents and what I've been able to research. If you have any other thoughts, questions, concerns, comments, questions, whatever, about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, more insights, whatever it may be, don't hesitate to let me know and to bring those things up. I'll be more than happy to discuss them, amend this episode, or create a whole new episode to talk about it. Just let me know. Thanks for listening.